Hello, everybody. Welcome to Why, Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. On today's episode, we're talking with William Eggington, author of the book In Defense of Religious Moderation. Thanks for joining us. A couple of years ago, my best friend Gail asked me why I was raising my daughter Jewish. She didn't mean, of course, why I chose Judaism as opposed to Buddhism or Hinduism, but rather why I was raising her with religious belief at all. I'm a pretty scientific-minded guy. I believe in evolution and the internal combustion engine. I don't think holy scriptures constitute evidence of anything, really. And I've met very few religious leaders who have any real moral authority. So I can certainly understand why she was puzzled. I told her something like this. I want Adina to grow up to see the world from a different point of view. I want her to be able to challenge the Christian assumptions that those around her take for granted and have a critical worldview from which she can truly examine herself and her surroundings. I want her to have the intellectual advantages Judaism provides. What will be surprising to many is that my answer was not based on faith or redemption, but rather on the role of religion in critical thinking. We've been educated by the politics of the last three decades to think that religion is a voice against progress, that it is blind faith in service of a long-gone world. But this is a caricature of my denominational beliefs, at least. Mainstream Judaism believes in progress and in scientific and moral discovery. It's liberal and democratic, and it is most certainly not evangelical. Most Jews just want to be left alone to worship in peace. Modern commentators like Christopher Hitchens, the author of God is Not Great, and Richard Dawkins, the author of The God Delusion, cite religion as the cause of tremendous evil in the world. They're no doubt correct, but they ignore the essential creations and discoveries that led to the positive aspects of the world today. Christianity's Sistine Chapel and Mozart's Requiem, Islam's preservation of Aristotle and their use of mathematics and logic, Buddhism's focus on critical self-awareness. Each of these is as essential to our lives as electricity. Consider the day of rest. When Judaism invented the Sabbath, it was recognizing both the fundamental dignity and physicality of the person. It was demanding that not every day be one of labor, but that at least one day per week be devoted to thinking, healing, community, and of course, rest. Americans have, to a certain extent, forgotten what rest is. What would our lives be like without this day off? How much worse are weeks now that even on our off days we check our smartphones and run errand after errand? How many of us actually start Monday feeling rejuvenated? In the face of these intrusions, the religious mindset gives us a meaningful motivation to keep one day holy and to protect our physical and psychological health. My point is not that a scientific worldview can't tell us the value of resting. Unlike Hutchins and Dawkins, unlike Pat Robertson or Sean Hannity, I do not believe that religion and science are at war with each other. And my point is certainly not that Judaism is better than any other religion. I don't think our beliefs are one another's concerns at all. I mean two things instead. First, religion provides rest with meaning, not just a scientific justification. And second, that with this one single shift in the week, Judaism focused an unchallengeable critical lens on the way that people before it thought about human life. As a philosopher, as a citizen in a democracy, as a person who believes in scientific truth, I can be nothing but grateful for this monumental challenge to the idea of human as tireless work machine. In today's episode, we're going to talk about religious moderation. Our guest is going to make the case for a certain kind of religious belief, for why it's not susceptible to the attacks of people like Hitchens and Dawkins, and why this religious moderation is to be preferred to either fanaticism or secularism. In the midst of the discussion, I'd like everyone to keep asking themselves, not just what the political or moral consequences are, but what religion does for the critical mind. Not every religious belief is healthy, and not every religious movement is positive. But in being fair, in being intellectually honest, we must recognize that most of human history, our progress and regress, was connected to religious practice, and some of it was unequivocally good. If we wish to eradicate that, we eradicate much of our past and the future that we strive to create. And now we turn to our guest. William Eggington is Andrew W. Mellon, Professor of the Humanities and Chair of the Department of German and Romance Languages and Literatures at the Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of numerous books, including the aptly named In Defense of Religious Moderation. Bill, thanks for joining us on Why.
Thank you for having me, Jack.
If you'd like to join the conversation, please email us at askwhy@und.edu. That's askwhy@und.edu. Tweet us at whyradioshow or post a question at facebook.com/whyradioshow. We'll take calls later on in the show, but feel free to join the chat room at www.whyradioshow.org. So, Bill, I guess I want to start off by saying that I think this is a bit of an odd topic for a book. I mean, isn't America a religious country? Aren't the atheists the one that are out of step? Why are you writing a book defending our religious beliefs?
Well, to begin with, by the way, coming after your extremely eloquent defense of moderate religious belief in the intro, this is a hard act to follow.
Oh, but that's very kind.
To begin with, it was really true. I was really quite touched by the words you had to say at the beginning of the show. But I think the first point to make is that the really important word in the title of the book is actually moderation. My book is not so much a defense of religion against secularism, which, and if it were, then I would completely agree with you. That would, in a sense, almost be taking the wrong side. It's a defense of a particular kind of religious belief, and I would say a different kind of believing altogether. That, as I try to make the point in the book, a great number of people throughout this country, in fact, practice on a day-to-day basis, but that gets completely ignored, especially by those on the secular side who have been so vociferously attacking religion in recent years. So the point is, in fact, to defend not religion against secularism or against atheism, but to defend moderate religious belief against fundamentalisms of either kind. And the point that I want to get to is it may well be, in fact, I believe it is, that a society that widely practices what I call moderate religious belief is in fact a society that's less susceptible to the evils of fundamentalism.
Now, there are people who would respond to this by saying, well, all this is well and good, but in the last 20, 30 years, the public religion has become more fundamental. And so the division that you're suggesting isn't really the division that we see on the media, in the newspaper, even on the street corners with the protest signs.
Well, I think that's exactly the problem, that as we see an increase in fundamentalisms of all kinds, you see that they feed on each other, right? I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that thinkers like the late Christopher Hitchens, brilliant man, I think, Dawkins, Sam Harris, that people like them are selling books the way that they do by, in part, overemphasizing their claims, right? They make a very, very strong point against religion, and it helps sell books. But it also has a side effect of intensifying the fervor of the rhetoric, intensifying the venom on either side, making those who are religious feel like they're in a more besieged minority, and making them fight back even harder. What I would say to my friends on the secular side of this debate, as they so conceive it, and what I try to tell them in this book, is not only our society today, but especially looking across cultures and across histories, an enormous, vast, vast majority of all people who have ever lived have had some kind of a religious affiliation, a deep-held religious belief. It is really pie-in-the-sky thinking to feel that you're going to eradicate religion in order to achieve the kind of rule by science that I think that they are obviously in favor of. So unless you want to adopt this kind of completely fantastic thinking, it's far better to think about how can you, in fact, establish common ground to talk to people. And one of the things that moderation in religious practice does do is allow one to approach that kind of a common ground.
So what is this fundamentalism, and how does it differ from what you're calling moderate religious belief?
So, Jack, my suggestion in the book is that fundamentalism that we tend to approach or that we tend to associate religious practice or religious beliefs with, fundamentalism is a way of thinking that can be applied or can be used to describe any number of different kinds of practices, not just religious ones. You're fundamentalist about something if you are convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that you have somehow accessed the ultimate truth about that thing, whatever it is. And I make some kind of jokes in the book about, you know, you could be a fundamentalist about baking, or I think I said about whose paella is the best. The difference being, and I do say most of us are fundamentalists about a lot of things. I tend to be quite an unbearable fundamentalist about coffee. But that this doesn't lead to a great deal of violence for the most part. However, once you start to get your ideas to be fundamentalist about where someone else is building their temple, or what the ultimate purpose of this particular swath of land is and who it belongs to, because God said so, then obviously those sorts of disputes have a great deal of potential for violence. So fundamentalism, we see it more in certain ways, but it is a kind of thinking that extends beyond just religious thought. It is a thinking that is based on the absolute certainty that you have access to the truth.
So you brought up coffee, and I know you're sort of making a joke, and you brought up baking, which our long-term listeners will know touches a nerve with me. And the first thing that pops into my head is the question, and this isn't the real question, but the question is, what's the difference then between a fundamentalist and a snob, right? The person who, you know, only says certain bread is worth eating, only says certain coffee is worth drinking. But at the heart of that question is a deeper philosophical question, which is, don't those snobs, aren't they really committed to the fact that the great unwashed wouldn't know a loaf of bread if it hit them over the head? And therefore, the fundamentalists are saying, look, you just don't know any better, and we do. And to be asked to compromise and moderate is to walk away from a truth that we're pretty confident about and our lives have to be committed to in order to be moral people.
Well, Jack, I think you're right. It is a kind of snobbery, although in a way calling what we recognize as fundamentalism snobbery or snobbishness does tend to underplay it a little bit, right? Because, I mean, the problem is, I guess I would put it this way, most people, if pressed to recognize their snobbishness, would recognize ultimately that this, okay, well, you know, this is important to me, but it's not, you know, the fate of the world doesn't hang in the balance. If, you know, you're not going to agree with me about the quality of my baking, the quality of this bread, well then, okay, I think you're wrong, but guess what? Yeah, we can live with that. When applied to these vast issues of metaphysical cosmic importance, suddenly they take on a whole different value. But that said, I would agree with you that the basic structure is the same. So the trick is, and I think that there's some truth to this, arriving at a kind of practice in, for example, the religious sphere that I would call religious moderation tends to leak over into other areas of your life. So that those who practice religion in a moderate way tend to be the sorts of people who would be more open to and more cognizant of the possibility that other people might have a point in no matter what walk of life they're participating in.
And this leads to what for many will be the most controversial point of the book, which is that the critics and the fundamentalists are actually in some sense the same. They're cut from the same cloth. And so Hitchens and Dawkins are both fundamentalists, albeit scientific as opposed to religious fundamentalists.
Well, you know, Jack, this is not a new claim, however, and a number of people have made this point. I think Jonathan Haidt, for example, has made this point. Now, Sam Harris Dawkins, when responding to this, they get quite upset at the notion that they would be fundamentalists when they accept essentially scientific viewpoint of the world. However, in my debating with these authors in the pages of this book, I made an effort to take their arguments seriously, and I would go and actually read books and quote statements by, for example, Sam Harris, that in fact show a great deal of admiration for fundamentalists, where he says, Well, if you're a religious moderate, essentially you're believing the same thing. It's just a watered-down version. Essentially, he's saying to religious moderates, you don't have the courage of your convictions. But the fundamentalists, they may be completely wrong, but at least, you know, at least they've got the courage of their convictions. Now, I don't have his book in front of me, and I'm not quoting him verbatim there, but that is very much the tenor of the approach that he takes to the problem. My approach is completely different, is to say, you know, religious moderates aren't just watered-down version of fundamentalists. They approach the very issue of truth in a radically different way. They have a different way of believing things. And that, in fact, the irony is Sam Harris's approach to his position is so much closer to the way that fundamentalists believe that I think that there is some truth in saying that, in fact, they're two sides of the same coin.
This, first of all, this notion that moderate is just a watered-down version. I'd like you to tell the readers in a second about this cartoon that you mention in your book, because it's a really good illustration. But the second thing is that you think both of them, both sets of people, are taking an approach, what you call the truth is out there, sort of stealing an X-Files reference there.
Right.
After you talk about the cartoon, talk a little bit about this, the truth is out there approach, and how that unifies their project against the moderate project.
Well, the cartoon that you're referring to, I describe at the beginning of the last chapter of the book. And, you know, honestly, when I was researching the book, for the life of me, I couldn't find it. So I don't know if I've dreamt it up, but it's
it could
really
be a vision from
mind.
God, right?
Oh, I mean,
you're missing your fundamentalism right here, right now.
Maybe it's something like that. But it was shortly after 9/11, and I think the country was still reeling from the shock. And it may have been the New Yorker, it may have been some other publication. I've searched through them, not been able to find it. But there's this cartoon, a one frame cartoon, a picture of a turbaned teacher in front of a classroom of other turbaned students, and a board is up there, and he's got a ruler, and he's pointing to the picture, and he says. Underneath, the caption is "Moderate Taliban," and he points to some drawings on the board, and he says, "Now you see, we fly medium-sized planes only half filled with fuel into medium-sized buildings." And my point in citing the cartoon was that I thought the cartoon really grasped the inanity of the notion that somehow moderation and fundamentalism were two spots on the same spectrum in some way, right? That moderation was just halfway there. That really, to be a fundamentalist, you're thinking in a completely different way, or in that sense, a fanatic. You have to be thinking in a completely different way to take your truth, your beliefs, to the point where you would do something so evil and so damaging to another person.
And the justification for this is that the truth is out there, that there's a code of codes, which is a Rorty phrase that you use in the book, to describe a certain attitude about what the world is and how we can describe it.
That's right. It was thanks to some students, and we were reading some texts in a course a couple years ago, right before this book was going to press, and I had been using this term, the code of codes, that I'm about to explain over and over again in the book, not entirely sure where it came from, and sure enough, there it was in one of the writings of my old teacher, Richard Rorty, back from Stanford. And I was grateful that I had gotten it in time to be able to then acknowledge it in the book. But so Rorty's point and mine here in identifying fundamentalist belief with this belief in a code of codes is that, well, you know, all the different practices we were talking about before, be it baking, scientific discourse, politics, or all the way up to religious belief, each one is inscribed in a particular what you could call a code, right? And I use code in the linguistic sense, like you and I are speaking in a certain code or register that is involved with philosophical discourse, and then when I go home and talk with my kids, I'm going to switch codes, and I'm going to have a different way of speaking with my daughter and my uh, my four-year-old son with whom I just spent the day here in Baltimore. So I had to switch codes to come in into the studio and talk with you. And that each of these codes is appropriate for what we're dealing with at any moment in our lives. Code of codes is the notion that underlying all of these codes is this kind of master code of the universe, that they all are somehow little pieces of, but that that master code of the universe, this giant bit of knowledge, is if we could just translate everything about our consciousness into it, we would have the knowledge of the world. So it's the idea that the world not only exists, the universe is out there in its totality and its completeness, but that it exists as a kind of knowledge, and that if we have the key, we can translate into that knowledge, right? That's what this, to use that X-Files phrase, the truth is out there, would mean that the truth already written as a kind of understandable language is out there. And once you crack that master code, you have access to it.
When we come back from the break, I want to follow up this notion a bit and pull the thread of what we can know and what we can't know and really examine where we go with this, what you end up calling a guilt by association, this notion that when people describe, when the critics describe religious belief, they're really miscategorizing things. But you're listening to Wire Radio Show. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're listening to William Eggington as well, talking about the case for religious moderation. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back listening to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. If you'd like to participate in the discussion, email us at askwhy@und.edu or tweet us at Why Radio Show. Check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/Why Radio Show or, of course, join the chat room at whyradioshow.org. You know, when I read Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, I was very excited and very interested. It certainly touches on some subjects that I take with deep curiosity, and I was really disappointed. I was really disappointed for some of the reasons that I discussed in the beginning of the show, which is he ignores many of the great achievements of religious civilization, of religious history. And what I came to realize is that what he was making, the mistake that he was making in my mind, was the scientist's mistake. And what the scientist's mistake was in my head is that only the last answer counts and only the right answer counts. So everything that happens before doesn't matter. And so I'm going to channel my friend Gail here again, and she won't mind because I always do it with great love and affection. And what she would respond to this is, but there is no God. And so it doesn't matter what happened before, there is no God. And since there is no God, all the other stuff is irrelevant. And so I guess the question that I have for you, Bill, and the question, the way that I want to approach this is my sort of resistance to that way of thinking simply, I'm an intellectual historian and I like the mistakes that happened before and I think the mistakes help me understand what's happening now. And what I really have to adopt is the scientific perspective, and it doesn't matter how we got to understanding 1+1=2, 1+1=2, and there is no God, therefore all this other stuff is meaningless.
Well, you know, Jack, I mean, science is absolutely right today about the questions that it pertains to science to ask until, of course, the scientific method leads to a new model. My position on this issue of religious fundamentalism and religious moderation is not very different from a lot of scientists who are willing to say, you know, the scientific method asks certain questions, and it's come up with a way of answering those questions very, very well. The scientific method has never been used, or shouldn't be used, to ask big questions about the ultimate meaning of life, the universe, and everything. It's really a kind of poor tool to ask questions about the relationship between individuals in a society, the meaning of our cultural institutions and practices. There's all sorts of ways that we can believe things, and this is a point that I make at the beginning of the book. Well, there's all sorts of statements that we make about the world. Very few of them line up in such a way that they can be verified or proven false by using the scientific method.
We have a question from the chat room from Duca, who is in Germany, so you've got quite an international audience here. And he writes, when I have a conversation with people, no matter what the topic is, I always expect some level of open-mindedness. Isn't that what moderation is? So what do you mean by moderation? And is it the Socratic critical skepticism, or is there something more going on there?
Well, it is open-mindedness, absolutely. But the idea of moderation, when taken in specifically in the field of religious debates, has to do with a different understanding of faith. As I say at some point in the book, that faith is constantly caricatured by the authors that I'm debating with. It's caricatured as belief without evidence. And as I say, well, very often what faith really is for those who are practicing it in various forms of religious moderation, that what faith really is for them is belief in statements, in belief in practices, belief in forms of life for which there couldn't possibly be any kind of evidence. So yes, in a broad sense, what we're talking about sitting down at a table and having a conversation, moderation is about being open. An open-mindedness, an openness towards the other person's perspective. Specifically in the question of religious discourse, then this religious moderation has to do with the way a faith is practiced.
Right. You argue in the book that these critics attack all religious people as if they were all literalists, and that this is just not true.
That's exactly right, Jack. And I think the reason that they have to do this is because the argument, well, because first of all, literalism is so outrageous that it makes a very easy, very broad-sided target.
And just to interrupt for a second,
by
literalism, we of course mean that there are no metaphors in the Bible, that when it says creation took 6 days and then a day of rest, there was six exact days and a day of rest, that everything has to be interpreted literally without any latitude or leeway.
That's exactly right. And now, the funny thing is that, you know, when I've made this point, I've been criticized by certain assertive atheists as parroting their own position, and they will object and say, you know, but atheists are perfectly aware, for example, that Roman Catholics, for the most part, are not biblical literalists. But again, I say, well, but I need to take you at your word, and you by you I mean the atheists that I respond to specifically in this book, Bill Maher and his film Religious, Chris Hitchens, Sam Harris, Dawkins, that they, in order to make the points that they're making, they in fact do have to pull this sleight of hand by which they replace all religious belief with biblical literalism, for example. And the point that I would make, and the point that I try to make especially in the last chapter, in which I rely a lot on the terrific sociological work of Alan Wolfe, who actually goes out and with his team of researchers and talks to people and tries to understand what they mean by statements like, yes, I believe in the second coming, for example. That it turns out that even that large swath of the American population that would seem to be embracing a kind of literal interpretation of the Bible, in fact, the way that they live their lives, it turns out that what they mean when they say they believe something isn't what Sam Harris needs them to mean when they say they believe something.
So what do they believe?
that belief itself, you can ask them the question, and Sam Harris refers to, I've never been able to find the research behind this, but let's say that it's true, three-fifths of the population of the United States says that they believe in the second coming, or something like that. That therefore, this means, Sam Harris says, that there is, there's three-fifths of the population of the United States that you just can't reason with, because they've accepted an absolutely unreasonable and unverifiable truth as kind of the ultimate truth of existence. And my point is that if you use the research of a sociologist like Alan Wolf, who goes out and he talks to people, you find out, well, when you ask that, well, does the fact that you believe this mean that the fellow down the street or your neighbor or the guy that you have dinner with every week who is a practicing Jew or is himself non-religious, that he's then necessarily wrong about the belief that he or she upholds and that contradicts yours? And the majority of people that he would then interview and ask questions would say, well, no, that doesn't mean that, because my belief pertains only to my family and what we do in our daily lives, and in no way does it contradict someone else. Well, this means that whether or not they have the vocabulary to explain it, they precisely are not believing in their religious beliefs the way that they would then believe in something completely verifiable, like the statement, it is raining outside. They're believing it more like the way you would believe a statement like, Mozart is the greater composer than Bach, or vice versa. Something that you could maybe have a reasoned argument for, or maybe even not at all. You could say, I like vanilla ice cream better than chocolate. Or you can say it in another way. You can say, I believe that vanilla ice cream is better than chocolate. In fact, most children, when they argue, use precisely that kind of discourse. In other words, many of the statements that we make about the world have the form of a proposition that would be somehow verifiable by uncovering the truth of the statement and showing it one way or the other. But the majority of them, in fact, don't have that form.
So, the political philosopher in me now is thinking, well, you're walking on dangerous ground here, because what it sounds like you're saying is all of these participants in a democracy, they don't really know what they're saying. They don't really know what they're believing. That if the sociologist asks them, what do you believe, they say it. But they're experiencing not even a kind of false consciousness, but a kind of lack of self-awareness that what they say they believe and what they believe are two fundamentally different things. So is that what you're saying? And is that a challenge to a democratic citizen as an agent who gets to articulate their own beliefs and act on it? How do we deal with this level of self-knowledge and the complexity involved in the difference between what a person says they believe, what a person thinks they believe, and what a person actually believes?
Well, I think it speaks more to the level of articulation that's possible with certain research tools. Namely, when you put out a survey, there's only a certain number of questions that you can ask, and therefore, there can be very good research tools. Pew surveys on religious life can have very interesting data. But unless you're willing to go and actually sit down with sample groups, with focus groups of those who have actually answered that, to delve into what they mean, then you're not going to actually come to the answer of what does it mean when you say you believe in the second coming, or that you believe in a virgin birth. Do you believe this in the same way that you would say, I believe this or that? I don't think it refers necessarily to a false consciousness or an inability on the part of believers to articulate these distinctions. I think maybe that is the case, that some are less able than others to articulate distinctions, minor or major distinctions in the use of our language. I think it simply points to the fact that, as in a lot of areas, we use language in different ways. And the word I believe, or the very notion of belief, has multiple possibilities of intensity, of reference, and we tend to think of it in terms of, and especially those atheist critics of religion tend to think there is only, in fact, I'm not going to say tend to, Sam Harris outright says I believe that X is Y can only have one meaning. It is the proposition X is Y, and it can be proven or disproven by whether X really is Y or not. And that, I think, is a highly, highly limited and quite frankly, self-serving view of how we use language.
So your criticism that the critics and the fundamentalists are cut from the same cloth, that they are all fundamentalists, takes another approach, which is Sam Harris is being a literalist when it comes to the word belief, when in fact there needs to be much more flexibility of the language, and belief is a homonym, and it means a variety of different things, even though it's spelled the same way.
I think that's exactly right, and I think he's being a literalist because he wants the position that he's taking down to only be a literalist position. So he's assuming that because that's the easiest position to take down. But I think a far more flexible, subtle understanding of how people actually use language and how people actually articulate their beliefs, if one does the research, one finds that that's in fact the case, even in a country like the United States where a good majority of the people living here do self-identify as religious and specifically Christian.
And so now I want to point to a different conversation that you had in the book. You ask where fundamentalism comes from, and you talk about a variety of different approaches, including her name's Karen Anderson, I think is her name, the famous religious historian. Fallen
Armstrong.
Out of my, thank you,
Armstrong.
Karen Armstrong. Mm-hmm. And then you have this aside where, I mean, aside isn't the right word, but then you take a different direction and you talk about the Scopes monkey trial, the famous trial as to whether or not evolution should be considered a topic for school. And you use that as a point of reference for when fundamentalism in the United States really came into being. Could you talk about that a little bit? Because what the point that you want to make is that the fundamentalist critics, the atheist fundamentalists, are as responsible for the religious fundamentalists as the religious fundamentalists are themselves.
Well, it was one example that we see of a phenomenon that that has repeated itself throughout modern history, is that when societies or communities within a society retrench themselves around a particular religious practice, fundamentalism in the United States, fundamentalist Christianity in the United States, what we now refer to as fundamentalist Islam, although there's a lot of debate about whether that's the proper translation of the term, but the idea would be that kind of an intense fanatic devotion to a particular religious tenet. That time and time again, what we've seen is that these communities emerge in reaction to a perceived belittling or reaction to perceived attack. And so I drew the parallel between some of those incidences, the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in North Africa, for example, as emerging in reaction to both the perceived rise of modernity in that cultural sphere and specific perceived attacks on their own cultural institutions. And to make that more present to an American audience, I talk precisely about the retrenchment of the religious community around the question of creationism after H.L. Mencken's it's perceived by some as quite vicious attacks on that community. The point being that embrace of creationism in particular, in fact, was not one of the core principles of the return to fundamentals movement in the early part of the 20th century, which the term fundamentalism was in fact came from. The fundamentals, these volumes, was not so much about that. It was a resistance against what they referred to as the new criticism at the time, a kind of secularization or loosening up of interpretation in Protestant theological schools. So in fact, it was a much more theological debate until the Scopes monkey trial. But out of that came this renewed insistence on a particular tenet within within fundamentalism, and that itself drove the movement. And so you have this nowadays, we think of Christian fundamentalism in particular as being really galvanized around two issues. One of them is an intellectual issue, and the other a moral issue, broadly drawn. The intellectual issue is the question of creationism and the teaching of creationism in schools, and the moral issue, of course, is the abortion debate. And that these two issues, in fact, have relatively recent historical trajectories to them, and that understanding them in their history can be enlightening.
That's right. In the 1970s, in fact, most Protestants were pro-choice, and this notion, and we all know it, right? We all know it from family fights. Along comes someone who, you know, you say something, and maybe you mean it, maybe you don't, and your brother, your sister, your parents, your friends give you a hard time about it, and your attitude isn't, okay, you're right. Your attitude is, no, I'm going to dig my heels in. Right. And so along come people who make fun of you for believing in creationism. And instead of saying, yeah, all right, Darwin might have had a point, you say, no, I am going to fight this. And that the last 100 years has just been both sides digging their heels in, fighting for the extreme. And so, of course, what you are trying to do is find that middle ground and find that call for moderation. And you make not just the historical argument, but the philosophical argument that at heart, both fundamentalisms have a commitment to the idea that the universe can be known as a whole. Mm-hmm. And that Dawkins in particular really believes that you can know how the universe operates, whether on the micro scale of DNA or the macro scale in terms of cosmology, don't we as philosophers, don't we as scientists, don't we as people need to assume that things can be known in order to progress and discover?
I absolutely think that things can be known, and I absolutely believe that a commitment to the progress of knowledge is absolutely essential to human society and to my outlook on the world. My difference with someone like Dawkins, and I really sort of debate him about the issue of agnosticism, is the idea that So let me back up a little bit and say, you know, Dawkins makes some very, he's a very funny writer, and he makes some funny points about agnosticism. And he doesn't like the kind of agnosticism he thinks of as kind of perpetual fence sitting, right? He says it's fine to be agnostic. I can't remember the exact term that he uses, but to be an agnostic, not in principle, but just sort of in practice. The idea is I'm agnostic about this fact or the other because I assume that at some point the answer is going to come along. But what Dawkins is particularly exercised about is the notion of agnostics in principle, right? He says if you're an agnostic in principle and you basically say there is no other place to sit but the fence from here on into eternity because one cannot know, that that's a real problem. Now, my point is not that there's any one particular thing, one great mystery that's out there in its little place that we're never going to be able to pierce, and that mystery has the name God, for example. No, not at all. My point about agnosticism is that the very notion of a totalized knowledge, knowledge of absolutely everything in the world, is an incoherent notion to begin with. But this requires progress. Precisely because infinite knowledge is impossible, we will always be learning by necessity. And there's a little story that I like to quote. It's a very little story. It's literally a paragraph long, and it's by one of my favorite authors, who's the Argentine poet Jorge Luis Borges. It's called Of Rigor in Science. I'm not going to quote the whole thing, but I easily could. It would take less than a minute, this paragraph. But basically, he talks about the cartographers of the emperor. The emperor sent out to have them make a map of the land. And first, they made a very large map. I don't know. It was the size of a city. So you can imagine how detailed that was. And he thought, this is great, but not good enough. So then they go and they make it the size of a state. And he says, again, much better, but still not quite enough. And then finally, they made a map of the empire that was, in every way, the size of the empire. It was perfect in every way. And then Borges ends by saying, "And the rags of this map and the civilization it represents are still floating around in the desert someplace." And the idea there is that knowledge, by definition, can only be a useful tool insofar as it's an abstraction of some kind. So there always is some kind of a break between, or some kind of a disconnect, some kind of a fundamental minimal abstraction between how one knows the world and the world in and of itself. And that is a necessity for knowledge itself. And where that, in that gap, we're always going to posit some kind of a transcendence, because we cannot possibly, by virtue of who we are and by virtue of what knowledge is, we cannot know all there is to know.
So once again, we have this attack on literalism, right? Once again, we have this sense that a map of the empire has to be the size of the empire, or it's not a real map. But that defeats the purpose of what a map is. We need these abstractions, because that's part of what makes human beings human. And so what you're really emphasizing is the role of abstraction and the role of generalizations in both science and religion, and that mm-hmm. each kind of abstraction plays a different role with different standards of evidence and different notions of when they're relevant and when they're not.
I think that's exactly right, and that's one of the reasons why I think that there's absolutely no contradiction in being a moderate religious believer and being a scientist. In fact, I found plenty of them in writing my book and had wonderful conversations with them. People who espouse different religions, from Christianity to Judaism. I had a terrific conversation with an evolutionary biologist who's also a practicing Mormon. None of these people saw any contradiction in their religious belief and in their scientific practice, because they were not using their science to make all-encompassing statements about the ultimate nature of the universe. And when their religion would seem to be making such kind of pronouncements, they were not understanding it to be a literal representation of the world.
And so then we get comments like we have in the chat room from Allie Kay, which says that, you know, she doesn't think evolution and creationism are mutually exclusive. And so you have that whole discussion too, trying to find mutual ways of overlapping the same idea in different ways, in different metaphors, in different images. And yet you're also skeptical of that, right? Because you're not always comfortable with the idea of religion and science always on an equal plane.
Well, I've, in a sense, my response to someone who would say, well, I don't find them incompatible, I said, well, you're probably right, but they're also not trying to do the same thing. To the extent that that creationism or intelligent design is trying to compete in the same sphere as a highly established scientific theory like the theory of evolution, that it's trying to compete for the same and using the same criteria and the same form of evidence, then you're really getting off on the wrong foot. I don't have a lot of patience for that. However, if you're willing to say creationism is not a science, the story of the creation of the universe is a story that's told in one of the foundational texts of my religious system. It's a story that I like to sit around with other members of my religious community and interpret and to think about what it possibly means for the world. But then when we go to a biology class and we talk about how certain organisms come up, we discuss the evidence that exists for the theory of natural selection, and we see how speciation might be taking place in particular cases. If you're talking about the two discourses existing side by side in that form, then I have absolutely no problem.
I want to change the tone a little bit, because I want to ask you about something that you do at the end of the book. After most of your discussion, some of which gets quite technical and some of which gets quite philosophical and other stuff is tremendously accessible, you say, it's about time that I forget whether you used introduced yourself or sort of reveal mm-hmm. yourself. And then you end up talking about your own religious education and your own religious experience and interpersonal interactions. And of course, I did something similar in the beginning of the show, although my readers sort of know, my listeners are know where I'm coming from. Why? This happens a lot, that people feel the need in terms of controversial arguments to reveal biographical facts. Why did you feel compelled to do that? What did the personal stories and the biographical and the confessional aspect, so to speak, of the book, what does that add to the argument, and why is that so important for credibility in this discussion?
That's an interesting question. What I can tell you is I did not feel compelled to do it, but I did make the choice to do it. And I think I made that choice in part because when I have spoken about these issues in the past, I almost invariably get the question at the end. And I felt if readers who were so generous as to read the book thus far were invariably, it seemed to me, going to be having this question, then why not grab the bull by the horns and talk about it up front? It also made sense to me. One reason it made sense to me is because, if I'm being honest, and I hope that in writing a book, one way or the other, you call me a philosopher, an academic, a professor, one of my jobs is to search for the truth. So I hope that I'm being honest when I write a book. That if I were being totally honest, I would have to say, you know, I came to think about these questions also through personal reason and a personal history that then I describe at the end of the book. So I think it was part of simply, yes, it's a confessional mode, but I really felt that that it was pertinent and appropriate given the subject matter.
Now, I'm going to push you on this because it ties to what I always call the problem of conversion, right? My students, the vast majority of whom are Christian, either Protestant or Catholic, are very familiar with the conversion of Saul and the road to Damascus to Paul. And I always say, well, this is fine. This is a story. But one person's conversion has no ramifications for anyone else. We're happy for Saul. We're glad that he found something. But there's no normative consequence of from an individual experience. And so I'm going to ask you the same question, which if I were to ask it crassly would be, so? But I'll be a little more respectful and say, well, but okay, this is your life history, and so that gives a personal motivation for writing the book, but what does it add to the debate? What information does it provide to help people make sense of the discourse and the controversy that you're laying out in the book?
Well, I guess I would right away admit that it's not an intrinsic part of the argumentation of the book. Now, on the other hand, if anything, it does help clarify the so question, if you were to put it that way. Because, in fact, I guess the point that I'm making at the end is while I did have a somewhat religious upbringing, I am a baptized Catholic. All of my children are baptized, and I'm married in the church with a Catholic wife. I'm an agnostic. In fact, I make the point in that chapter that ultimately we're all agnostics, and we're either agnostics who realize the fact, or we're agnostics who are attempting to cover that up in some way. And that the point that I'm making, in a sense, is, you know what? Whatever my religious affiliation is or could have been, the arguments in the previous four chapters still hold true, because they're philosophical arguments. They're not based on having a particular religious upbringing or having a particular denomination. They're philosophical arguments about the very nature of religious moderation and why having moderation in society in general is a good thing. So it is a defense of a kind of religious being that, quite frankly, nowadays I barely, if at all, even practice. I guess the point that I'm making in the end is it's a religion, it's a defense that I don't need for any personal motivation, that I'm doing it because it's the philosophical right thing to do.
You know, I have to say that even though we are off the air, there is still a very serious conversation going on Facebook and on Twitter, and I'm getting the comments as we talk, and there are two in front of me that point to some of the core ideas in the book and reactions. So Jose quotes from, I gather, from The Life of Pi, and the quote is, "I'll be honest, it's not the atheists who get me, but agnostics. Doubt is useful for a while, but we must move on. To choose doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation." And then Navy quote, writes a comment that there's a difference between being an atheist and being an anti-religious fascist. And then someone responds to that and asks, is there? And so you can see already, right, you can see in these comments the aggressive style, the hostility, the desperation, and yet, and also that call to action and the put up or shut up approach that responds to act. How do you respond to this level of vehemence? And how do you respond to the people who suggest that agnosticism is not a viable position because it's not a position of any kind?
Well, I obviously respectfully disagree. I, in fact, think that doubt but move on is, honestly, that's what agnostics do. you doubt about the ultimate questions. You doubt about the absolute certainty of your knowledge, but you act as we all do. Ultimately, you act in self-awareness. You act with the awareness that, in fact, you don't have the ultimate questions for everything. That there always can come a conversation that may change your mind about things, and that this is ultimately a very ethical position to take. And as far as whether atheists are anti-religious fascists or not, honestly, I think the vast majority of atheists and many whom I've talked to and many who have read my book and responded appreciatively are not in the slightest that. They are atheists in the sense that I describe agnostics at the end, which is people who are perfectly willing to listen to other people's opinions, respect their right to believe what they believe, and simply choose to believe or feel that in their lives that they believe that God does not exist. They are not certain that God does not exist, and they're not going to turn this into a soapbox for trying to convert everyone else. I do believe that the majority of atheists are like that. My contention was in the book that a certain number of assertive atheists are making their case in a way that is not good for the general political discourse, and that it was my job to try to answer them.
And I will say that the book really takes a very moderate tone. A book like this, you could end up being really angry at the author. And, you know, there's some parts someone isn't going to agree and some parts some people are going to disagree. But you don't get the sense that you are dividing people up into camps literally or figuratively. You get the sense that you're really trying to find a way. And that's why it would be so interesting to get Dawkins' response or Hitchens, where he's still alive, or Sam Harris's.
Alive,
Sam Harris's, because would they respond? Could you imagine? Put yourself in their shoes as best as you can. And then I'm going to go to the put yourself shoes in a question in a second. But put yourself in their shoes. And do you think that they would respond as vehemently to your argument for moderation as they respond to the arguments for religious belief?
Okay, so that's a little bit hard, because I would like to believe that they would not necessarily, if they heard me out and listened to the way that I was posing the problems, that they would find some way of finding some common ground with me, and perhaps say, for example, listen, okay, if you're defining atheism in those terms, if you're defining moderation in those terms, I think that we have some common ground. Now, unfortunately, in the few cases where atheists have actually responded to me, they have not taken that tone at all. They have felt their response has been beleaguered, defensive, and quite hostile. Daniel Dennett was quoted in an article about me as basically saying these arguments are not even worth the time, the paper that they're written on. Basically, I'm not going to even give them the time of day. Others have said, as I think I quoted earlier in the interview, said that I mischaracterize all atheism as taking all religion to be literalist. And, well, of course, I only characterize those who are in fact requiring the assumption of literalism for their arguments to make sense. And I'm perfectly willing to accept, as I just said before, that the vast majority of atheists don't believe that about religion.
So you have this position where they're accusing you of doing exactly the thing that you're accusing other people of doing.
That's right. And sorry.
No, that's fine. And so, I mean, is this just the nature of political discourse today, and that this is a form of activism and people are going to be vehement? Or is there something inherent in the discourse? Is there something in the content that necessitates this kind of recalcitrance?
You know, I would hesitate to say this, and at the same time, I do feel there is something to this, that precisely because those who I am reacted to in the book have a certain mindset that I believe I'm accurately describing as fundamentalist in a certain way, does in fact explain the tenor of their response.
Well, I have to say that Daniel Dennett has never responded to anything I ever did. So even though he was hostile, you're quite a few points ahead of me. I think for my last question, I want to go back to the thing I said about the problem of the scientist in the last question, that only the right question, only the last question counts. And I want to suggest, and I'm curious what you think about this, that you actually have a tremendous intellectual advantage because, as you are clear in the book, you come to this from literature. You come to this problem not through your own religious experiences, as you say in the book, but through reading Borges. And because you are reading literature as literature, it's easier for you to approach Holy Scriptures as literature and as acts of creativity, right? Religion, you talk about this and I allude to it, and it's very, very important that religion is a creative enterprise, both in the in the notion of Genesis, but also in the poetic element, in the humanist element. And so I would suggest that you have an intellectual advantage over the science-minded folks who look at books for answers rather than explorations. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's true? And if so, where do we go from here?
Well, I think that to the extent that it is true, and I do believe that having an interpretive approach to texts hardwires you for a kind of open-mindedness in thinking about the world, then I think where we go from here is, along with our calls, very worthwhile calls for increased funding for education in math and science and the STEM areas, is to also call for increases in funding and support for education in the humanities, in philosophy, in programs like what you're doing, Jack, in history, in languages, because the whole human brain is not just a machine that it needs to be hardwired to find one particular answer, like a piece of information written in a book. We are creative through and through, and the greatest scientists are also the people that have been in many ways the most creative examples of the human spirit.
So in the end, then, is the problem really not even the discourse, but the problem is the artificial separation of the disciplines that in the 21st century we think is real? There's this thing called biology, there's this thing called chemistry, there's this thing called English, there's this thing called sociology, there's this thing called religious studies, when in fact through most of human history, the trivium, etc., there was political economy, there was natural philosophy, there was moral philosophy, it was all connected. What it sounds like is that you're saying is ultimately the real problem is that we think of knowledge and inquiry as discrete divisions, when in fact what we need is a more holistic view of humanist exploration.
No, I entirely agree. And not only that, I believe that we have an inbuilt tendency that expresses itself in our language to evaluate knowledge along a spectrum of hard to soft. And that this does a disservice both to the kinds of knowledge that we refer to as the hard sciences as well as to the so-called softer disciplines of the social sciences and the humanities, because it makes it seem that knowledge is about scraping under the surface and finding something that's already there. And the harder the science, the more concrete the object that it's looking for. Whereas all human knowledge is fundamentally a creative act. So that being taught and being well instructed in different arts of reading and interpretation is fundamentally helpful for being a good mathematician, a good scientist, and vice versa, I would argue.
Well, that is a remarkable way to end. I couldn't agree more. And I think this conversation has been wonderful and just the kind of conversation that I was hoping to have on this radio show. So, Bill, thank you so much for your time, and thanks for taking your Sunday night and for putting yourself out there. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jack. I really enjoyed talking to you.
You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and William Eggington talking about the case for religious moderation. We'll be back with some thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Y Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We've been having an intriguing and controversial discussion about the role of moderation both in religious and scientific belief. And in the process, we had a comment from Evan in the chat room that basically says, we need to stand up to fundamentalism. We need to push it aside. And I think that that question really helps us understand that what a lot of these people are engaged in is not necessarily inquiry, but activism. Both the fundamentalists on the atheist side and the fundamentalists on the religion side, they have axes to grind. And they envision a world or a country that fits their political point of view. Now, maybe it's a good one, but nevertheless, that's not inquiry. That's politics. It's something else. We have to look at the language that we use. We have to avoid literalism in all forms. Well, maybe not all forms, but in key forms where we understand that belief doesn't necessarily mean the same thing at all times, and that we as individuals need the ability to find what we can find in religion and find what we can find in science and be tolerant and representative of other people's points of view. Right. I started the show by talking about a longstanding conversation I had with my best friend, and she and I have been tremendously different politically, religiously, intellectually at various different points of our lives. But what I get out of the relationship and what she gets out of the relationship is a fundamentally richer world. And ultimately, in the end, the question you have to ask is, which world is going to be the most satisfying? Which world is going to be the most rich and exciting and thrilling? And that is a world, shockingly, not of extremism, but of moderation. Because when you engage in moderation, you engage in a full, open-minded conversation with people whom you respect and learn from. And at the root, that's what William Eggington is calling for, a conversation of respect. Thank you so much for joining Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. As always, I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein, and it is an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.